today on All Things Soul is one of the leading jazz artists of his time. He is a world-class trumpeter, pianist, composer, nominated for 2 Academy Awards and recipient of 5 Grammy Awards. Born and raised in New Orleans, Terrence Blanchard was a childhood friend of Wynton and Branford Marsalis. He has collaborated extensively with my Morehouse College classmate, Spike Lee, in the soundtracks of many of his movies, including my favorites, Do the Right Thing, Malcolm X, Summer of Sam, and Jungle Fever. He has also composed the score for Spike's documentary that I'm sure is near and dear to his heart as a New Orleans native, When the Levees Broke, about Hurricane Katrina.
Yes.
He's even had a part in the Disney movie, Princess and the Frog, and has been the composer of the soundtrack in the movie Red Tails about the Tuskegee Airmen, a movie that is near and dear to me, given that my uncle, Robert Johnson, was a Tuskegee Airmen bombardier navigator and a participant in the Freeman Field Mutiny depicted in that movie. Finally, Terrence Blanchard is a long supporter and good friend of WBGO. Terrence, welcome to your favorite radio station, and thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Jay, for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back on BGO.
Let me begin by asking you how you developed your love of music and which musical instrument you picked up first growing up in New Orleans.
Well, first of all, being in New Orleans, it's kind of hard not to fall in love with music because you hear it all the time and it's everywhere. But for me, it was a special thing because my father loved opera and he sang. He was a baritone. My mom's, my mom's sister's husband, my Uncle Frederick, also was a singer. And his wife, my aunt, is a piano coach and vocal coach. And my grandfather played guitar. So there was music everywhere in the house. And, you know, I would always be shuffled off to some of my dad's performances when I was a little boy. I remember during Christmas, he would sing Little Drummer Boy to me, you know, at some of the church functions when I was like a little kid. But my grandmother had a piano and I would always go over to the house and try to bang on the piano. And they started getting me lessons when I was 5 years old. And I could never miss a lesson because my first piano teacher lived in the house right behind mine. So, you know, there was never any moment of not missing a lesson on the weekend, man.
Right.
I've been blessed because, you know, I've had great teachers. I've had great experiences with great musicians. And when I lived in New York, man, that was the time of my life because I just about met all of my heroes back then.
Who are some of your heroes in the music world, in the jazz world?
Well, as soon as I moved to New York, man, I started playing with Art Blakey and I met Woody Shaw, Freddie Hubbard. I already knew Clark Terry. I met Clark Terry while I was in high school in Milt Hinton. Dizzy Gillespie, Miles. Those are the people that I got a chance to meet while living in New York. And that was an invaluable experience back in those days, getting a chance to know those guys and having the ability to talk to them.
What were some of your, did you have a favorite jazz spot in New York when you lived in New York?
I had a few. You know, one of the ones that I used to love, it was called McHale's. We used to play uptown. I think it was on 95th and Columbus. We used to play up there with Art Blakey all the time. I remember one time, we would only do weekends, but I remember one time we did 5 weekends in a row up there at McHale's. And it was a great experience, man, because I got a chance to meet James Baldwin and Ralph Ellison. They were frequent members of that establishment. And then, of course, we used to play Sweet Basil's, you know, down in the...
Sweet Basil's, that was my favorite, on 7th Avenue.
Yeah, we used to play there all the time. As a matter of fact, we used to do the New Year's Eve week there all the time when I was playing with Art Blakey.
Did you play there much in the 1980s?
Yeah, that's when I was there. I played, you know, I joined Art Blakey's band in 82, and I was there from 82 to 86. And that was, man, that was the time of my life. I tell people all the time, you know, I was in that band for 4 years, but I felt like I aged by 40, you know, because of the experiences that I was having, the people that I was meeting, the musicians that I was encountering, and just being in New York. You know, it was a culture shock being a little country boy from New Orleans, Louisiana, living in a big city. But it really helped to mold me and train me, you know, in this business. And I wouldn't trade that for anything.
You know, if you were a regular at Sweet Basil's in the 1980s, 82 to 86, I'm almost certain that I saw you perform. Because I used to go there regularly all the time because I lived just a couple blocks away.
Oh, well, you definitely saw it perform because, man, whenever we played, there would be lines down the block, you know, when we played there with Art Blakey. And everybody used to come and see us, Bill Cosby, George Benson, Al Jarreau, Betty Carter. They were always lining up, you know, to come by and say hi to Art. And, you know, and there were always a good, you know, a number of musicians who would come by and hang out with us too.
So I went to Morehouse College, class of 1979, with a kid from Fort Greene named Sheldon, also known as Spike. Mm-hmm. And in the early 80s, he called me and asked me if I would invest in a new movie called She's Gotta Have It. And I gave him a few dollars. I managed to get in the credits of the movie. I'm not sure why. Maybe it was the $50 I gave him. How did you get to know Spike Lee?
You know, it was so interesting, man, because I remember when that happened. And I went to go see She's Gotta Have It in Chicago. And I remember saying to myself, you know, I'm a firm believer what you put out in the universe comes back to you, you know. And I remember saying to myself, man, I really would love to work with a guy like that who is as passionate about his art as I am and will do anything to be creative and tell stories in through his art form. And next thing you know, I'm being hired by Harold Vick, who was a saxophonist who was contracting a big band for School Days, you know. And I got a chance to meet Spike. I never forget it. The first session I walked in, well, you know, Spike, I had on a Lakers t-shirt, Lakers hat.
Uh-oh.
And Lakers had Converse, right? Yes. So as I'm walking into the studio, he looks me up and down. He goes, Lakers fan. I go, yeah, buddy, definitely. You know what I mean? he remembered me from then. And then, you know, things just progressed. When we did Mo' Better Blues, you know, he heard me playing something on the piano, asked to use it, then asked me to write a string arrangement for it. And that's how our relationship as a filmmaker and composer started.
Mo' Better Blues.
That raises an interesting question for me because I am definitely not a musician. Mm-hmm. If you have a talent for the piano, mm-hmm. does that talent transfer to another musical instrument like the trumpet?
Oh, it can. It can because for me, the way that I was taught, the piano is the foundation of everything. You know, because my composition teacher Roger Dickinson, he would always tell me. He said, "Listen, man, if you play something on the piano and the voicings work there, you translate that to orchestra, big band, and it all should work, you know? So also the piano allows you to see everything theoretically. You know, when you start to learn how to play against chords and use scales, when you sit down and you play a voicing, you know why this note up here resonates a certain way because of what's underneath it. And it helps you to theoretically understand how to improvise and how to create tension. You know, how to create different types of moods based on the harmonic notes that you choose.
Right. So if you asked me what is my favorite Spike Lee movie, I could not tell you because I have about a top five.
Yeah.
From your perspective, given the contributions you made to the movies, what do you have a favorite?
No.
Or a favorite two or three?
No, because I look at the body of work, you know, and the thing that always amazes me is that the guy who started off by doing She's Gotta Have It grew into the guy, you know, who did the Five Bloods, you know? And to watch that growth and expansion over the course of time is amazing. And then to see the epicenter, the documentary, which I thought was truly phenomenal, you know? And I'm looking forward to see what's happening with his next movie. I didn't work on the next documentary, but I'm really excited about seeing what he's doing with that as well. You know, Spike has been a person with immense talent, but doesn't stay in one place, you know?
Right.
That's the thing. that I love about him as an artist. You know, I try to do the same thing, and I'm trying to live my life the same way. It's not about regurgitating what you've done in the past or living on your successes. You know, you have to jump out there every time like the school board says zero, and just try to do the best you can to keep constantly growing and moving forward.
So much of Spike's movies are about race relations. What do you think was the message behind the movie Do the Right Thing?
Well, it's all about injustice and all about equality. You know what I mean? You know, we live in a country that said everybody's supposed to be free and freedom for justice and justice for all. You know, so that's really where it starts, I think, with Spike. I mean, we've had a lot of conversations about it, and it's not about, you know, preferring one person over the next. You know, it's about everybody getting an equal shot. And I think the first time that I went to his set, that really resonated with me because, you know, people like to label Spike as being the angry Black man. You know, back then, they don't do it so much now, but back then, that was kind of the moniker that was put on him. But when you went to his set, you couldn't see anything further from the truth because you saw every different type of person on the set. It wasn't about just, you know, celebrating African-American culture. It was about doing the best job. Who could do the job? Everybody right. had an equal shot at getting the job, you know, and whoever did the best job got it, you know. And that was something that I always appreciated about him because that was a big lesson for me. And hopefully it's a lesson for a lot of other young people who have been working with Spike, you know, because he does a great job of bringing in interns to give them experience, you know, and let them see how the sausage is made.
Terrence, when you compose an opera or an album, how do you measure success? Presumably not by just pure sales, but what to you is a success in your art?
Well, I think it's not just that. It's not sales, obviously. I mean, obviously that plays a role in it because we live in a country that where commerce is king, you know. But at the same time, it's really about how it resonates in the community. You know, the Met had normally been broadcasting their operas in Times Square the night of the premiere. And we kept saying, well, if you got to do that, you got to go to Harlem. You got to go to the community and also broadcast it there. So they went to Marcus Garvey Park. And from what I was told, because I wasn't able to be there, obviously, but the park was packed, full of people who really enjoyed the opera. And then the theater was packed with all different type of people. And from what we've been told since we've been here rehearsing Champion is that ever since that moment, the other audiences for the other operas have been more diverse since Fire. And that's a win-win for me because I really feel like, you know, opera is the music of the people. It's an expression of our culture. And that's the reason why we're trying to do these new shows, to do stories that are meaningful and relevant to people's lives today, you know? And as a result, people are showing up and supporting these projects.
So I'd like to ask you about Champion, the opera you've composed. I looked into the subject matter of it, and I was fascinated.
Yes.
I didn't know anything about this story. I had never heard of Emil Griffith or Benny the Kid Perrette, two welterweights. The championship went back and forth between the two of them in the 1960s. I was growing up, I was an Ali Frazier guy, heavyweight class, so I didn't pay much attention to welterweights. Right. But I researched the story for this interview, and I was fascinated by it. Griffith had this fight with Perrette on March 24, 1962. In the weigh-in, apparently Perrette uttered some sort of slur, a homosexual slur in Spanish. Perrette was from Cuba.
Yes.
Griffith was from the Virgin Islands. And they were both, you know, about 145, 147 pounds. They were fighting for the welterweight championship. And Griffith literally beat Perrette to death in the ring.
Yes.
I watched the film of the match, of the fight. And he literally beat him to death, probably hit him 20 times before he collapsed and never gained consciousness. And you have transformed this into an opera. How did you select this subject, and what is it you seek to portray in this opera about this fighter?
Well, I think the thing that we're trying to portray, first of all, is the idea of forgiveness. And when I say forgiveness, I'm speaking of being able to forgive yourself for something that has transpired in your life. And I'll tell you specifically what I mean with Emil. You know, obviously, you know, he killed his friend. Benny Perrette was a friend of his. He killed him in the ring. Well, he hurt him in the ring. He hit him 17 times, less than 7 seconds. And Benny subsequently died as a result, obviously. But years later, and I mean decades later, when Emil meets Benny Jr. for the first time, Benny Jr. tells him, you know, listen, we just want to let you know we don't harbor any ill will towards you from the family. And Emil just loses it. He cries.
I saw the film of that. Yes.
He cries like a baby. And you can just tell that was something that was weighing on his heart for the longest time. He couldn't forgive himself for what happened. As a matter of fact, you know, the story goes that, you know, after that, he tried to continue on with his boxing career, but never would go back into the corner, you know, because that's where he had the incident with Benny Perrette. So it's about forgiveness. The other part of it is, you know, about him dealing with his own sexuality and the world dealing with other people's sexuality. You know, he said something about how I killed a man and the world forgave me, yet I loved the man and the world wanted to kill me. And to me, that was a very profound statement, you know, because I thought it was a shame that this man would reach the height of his chosen endeavor and not be able to celebrate that with anybody that he loved openly. You know, first time I won a Grammy, dude, I turned around and kissed my wife, gave a hug and walked up on the stage without thinking about it. You know what I mean? It's just something that I have been afforded the ability to do. And to think that somebody like him would have to scurry around in the shadows to be with somebody that he loved was a shame. You know, so, but on two fronts, I'm trying to, you know, open the eyes of, you know, some hearts and minds out there about these issues. And then we have the whole idea of like what it was for Luis dealing with a person who's dealing with dementia. You know, my father had dementia and I dealt with it. My mom dealt with it for over 10 years, you know, before he passed. And that's a rough thing to deal with and to go through, you know, to watch somebody that you love deteriorate like that right in front of your eyes. So there's a few different angles that we're trying to really get across with this story.
Is there an element of exploitation or race in this story that you tell through this opera?
I mean, indirectly, you know, the exploitation part of it is definitely there, you know, because there are moments when you see him being successful and his mother taking advantage of his success or reeling in his success. So that part of it is definitely there. The racial component is not there as much as the sexual orientation component.
So how did you become a fan of WBGO?
Man, please. Man, it started when I was in college, you know, when I was at Rutgers University, man. WBGO saved my soul, man. I got a chance to keep that station on and hear a lot of great music, you know, and learn a lot, actually, you know, hear music that I would never have heard before. You know, that was the other thing that was really great about it. And that continued for years, man, while I lived in New York, you know. And I think the other thing that I really love about BGO is that it wasn't a radio station that just stayed at the facility. You know, BGO is actively out in the community, always working and trying to spread, you know, the information about what this music has done, you know, for people's lives. And I've always appreciated that, You know, that's why I've always tried to be a big supporter of theirs whenever I could do anything for him. I remember when he started doing the live performances at the station itself, I was all geeked to do one. And I remember doing one of the first ones for us back then and had a great time doing it. So, you know, I'm glad to see that BGO is still, you know, doing great things, moving along. And now we're into the digital realm, expanding, you know, even further, you know, it's outreach. You know, you have to be honored to be on the station and proud of what it is that you guys have been doing for a number of years.
So how do we pass jazz in particular to the next generation? How do we get the next generation interested in jazz and R&B?
Well, the first thing is just don't sugarcoat it. Just, you know, one of the things about kids today, man, you know, they don't want to be spoken to like kids or children, you know? And I think you just have to expose them to the music. You know, I think the thing that I've learned is that, you know, there are always going to be kids who find interest in this. And the beautiful thing about it is that this music can save a lot of people, and it has done it and will continue to do it, you know, because there's some kids out there that are going through things and they don't have the means to be able to talk about it or be able to discuss it with people. But the music can allow them to express themselves in a way that can really help their souls heal, you know. So that's why I'm a firm believer in stations like BGO going out into the communities, you know, trying to reach out to young people, let them know what's going on with this music and allowing them to come to it on their own terms. You know, it's not about preaching. You know, there's no need with this music. There's no need to preach. You know what I mean? The music is powerful on its own. And I've seen it so many times playing with Herbie Hancock, playing with so many other people where people come up to us and say, man, this is the first time I've heard something like this. And it really turned my head around. And you have to just, when that happens, you have to nurture that. You have to, you know, inspire that person to even go further, you know, because I know, especially when it comes to young people, we don't have to grab all of them. We just have to grab a few of them. Because when you grab a few of them, they go out and preach the gospel for you. You don't have to do it at that point. They'll become our biggest advocates.
Well, you'll be pleased to know, and I've noticed this during fundraising drives, the listeners of WBGO are not just in the New York, New Jersey, tri-state area. They are literally all over the world, multiple time zones. We get pledges and calls during fundraising drives from California, the Far East, mm-hmm. Western Europe. Mm-hmm. It's a very dedicated, committed listenership. It's really, really amazing. It goes back generations. So may I assume you're also an R&B fan?
Of course. Come on, man.
Who are your favorites?
Well, of course, you know, for me, you know what's interesting about that question? You know, with my sister-in-laws, they're a little older than me, so they go back to the Coasters and the Drifters and that whole period. You know what I mean? Right. But for me, I'm, you know, Earth, Wind & Fire, Mandrill, Parliament Funkadelic, Al Green, so forth and so on. Those are the guys that I had really grew up listening to as a kid. You know, Marvin Gaye, that was it for me.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Terrence, for your time today.
Thank you, Jay. Thanks for having me, man. I really appreciate the chance to be back on BGO. Loved it.